This is a listening paper of the 2017 Year 9 Final Examination in English. There are 4 tasks in the paper. You will hear all the tasks twice. Turn to Task 1. Task 1. You are going to hear a talk about Wilma Rudolph. You will hear the recording twice. Before you listen, read the sentences below. While you listen, complete the sentences. Write no more than 2 words in each gap. An example, 0, has been done for you. You now have 30 seconds to read the sentences.
Wilma Rudolph was one of America's first major national superstars in track.
Wilma Rudolph was born on June 23, 1940, in Tennessee, the 20th of 22 children. At age 4, she contracted polio. Her doctors said she would never walk again. But with physical therapy, leg braces, and true grit, Wilma Rudolph was walking by age 12.
During her high school years, Wilma Rudolph was a great basketball player, and Ed Temple from Tennessee State University saw her, and he saw a lot of potential, not only in basketball, but also in track. He had her work out with the college track team in the summers.
At age 16, Wilma Rudolph won a bronze medal in the 1956 Melbourne Olympic Games for the 4x100 relay. Returning to the U.S., she attended Tennessee State University on a scholarship, where Ed Temple continued her training. 4 years later in the Rome Olympics, along with Wilma, almost the entire U.S. track team consisted of Ed Temple's runners.
She was phenomenal in the 1960 games in Rome. The 2 sprint events she won in blowouts, and she anchored the relay team that had a come-from-behind victory to win gold as well.
Wilma Rudolph was the first American woman to win 3 gold medals in a single Olympics. She became an overnight sensation.
Wilma Rudolph returned home from the Rome Olympics to a hero's welcome. When she learned that her ticker tape parade was to be segregated, she refused to attend and forced a change.
Wilma Rudolph Day was the first integrated event in municipal history in the city of Clarksville, Tennessee.
Wilma Rudolph was only 22 years old when she retired from competitive sports in 1962.
She decided to go back to Tennessee State University, and she got her degree in teaching, and she became a teacher.
Rudolph would go on to coach track at Indiana's DePaul University, serve as a goodwill ambassador to French West Africa, and raise a family of 4 children.
Wilma Rudolph was inducted into the Black Athletes Hall of Fame in 1973, the National Track Hall of Fame in 1974, and she wrote her own autobiography titled Wilma, which was turned into a TV movie in 1977 called Wilma.
Listen again and check your answers.
Wilma Rudolph was one of America's first major national superstars in track.
Wilma Rudolph was born on June 23, 1940, in Tennessee, the 20th of 22 children. At age 4, she contracted polio. Her doctors said she would never walk again. But with physical therapy, leg braces, and true grit, Wilma Rudolph was walking by age 12.
During her high school years, Wilma Rudolph was a great basketball player, and Ed Temple from Tennessee State University saw her, and he saw a lot of potential, not only in basketball, but also in track. He had her work out with the college track team in the summers.
At age 16, Wilma Rudolph won a bronze medal in the 1956 Melbourne Olympic Games for the 4x100 relay. Returning to the U.S., she attended Tennessee State University on a scholarship, where Ed Temple continued her training. 4 years later in the Rome Olympics, along with Wilma, almost the entire U.S. track team consisted of Ed Temple's runners.
She was phenomenal in the 1960 Games in Rome. The two sprint events, she won in blowouts, and she anchored the relay team that had a come-from-behind victory to win gold as well.
Wilma Rudolph was the first American woman to win three gold medals in a single Olympics. She became an overnight sensation.
Wilma Rudolph returned home from the Rome Olympics to a hero's welcome. When she learned that her ticker tape parade was to be segregated, she refused to attend and forced a change.
Wilma Rudolph Day was the first integrated event in municipal history in the city of Clarksville, Tennessee.
Wilma Rudolph was only 22 years old when she retired from competitive sports in 1962.
She decided to go back to Tennessee State University, and she got her degree in teaching, and she became a teacher.
Rudolph would go on to coach track at Indiana's DePaul University, serve as a goodwill ambassador to French West Africa, and raise a family of four children.
Wilma Rudolph was inducted into the Black Athletes Hall of Fame in 1973, the National Track Hall of Fame in 1974, and she wrote her own autobiography titled Wilma, which was turned into a TV movie in 1977 called Wilma.
This is the end of Task 1. Turn to Task 2. Task 2. You are going to hear people expressing their opinion about their personalities. You will hear the recording twice. Before you listen, read the statements below. While you listen, match the statements B to I to the speakers and write the letters B to I in the table given. There are two extra statements you do not need to use. An example, zero, has been done for you. You now have 30 seconds to read the statements. Speaker zero.
What are my best qualities? This is a difficult question for someone to answer, I think, but I'll give it a shot. I think my best qualities are probably that I have a good sense of humor, I genuinely like people and I like talking to people, and I like to be entertaining, if I can possibly be.
Speaker one.
I am a terrible procrastinator. I will wait to pack for a big vacation on the day of the trip, on the day that I leave. I remember in school I used to wait to finish 20-page papers. I used to start 20-page papers 2 days before they were due. I am a terrible procrastinator.
Speaker two.
I always try to be positive and polite and friendly to people who I meet, especially the first time, and I try to continue that. But regardless of who they are, I try to give them, treat them friendly. I enjoy being friendly, so it's not really work to me. It's just part of my personality.
Speaker three.
So what's my best quality? I think my best quality has to be the ability to laugh at myself. English humor is very much based around laughing at yourself and also laughing with others at themselves. So my best quality definitely is that I can laugh at myself and with others when they laugh at me.
Speaker four.
Since I'm a musician, I make music. And when I make music, I tend to create some kind of song, and then right away I go to the next one before I even finish the last one.
Speaker five.
I want to find out new things. I want to go places. I want to have new experiences. I don't like to just sit around where I know everything because it stops being interesting and inspiring after a while. I like to have new things happen to me and meet new people, and that is what keeps me creative, and I have fresh ideas that way.
Speaker 6.
I say, you know, I want to do a big project, but then I realize, oh, wait a minute, you know what? I probably shouldn't have said anything because now everyone expects me to do it and I don't have any choice. Probably I should just do it and then talk about it later. You know, I have a bad habit of saying, gee, I think it would be a good idea if I did A, B, C. But then I think, oh, man, you know what? I don't think I'll be able to do that, at least not when I say I will.
Listen again and check your answers. Speaker 1.
I am a terrible procrastinator. I will wait to pack for a big vacation on the day of the trip, on the day that I leave. I remember in school I used to wait to finish 20-page papers. I used to start 20-page papers 2 days before they were due. I am a terrible procrastinator.
Speaker 2.
I always try to be positive and polite and friendly to people who I meet, especially the first time, and I try to continue that. But regardless of who they are, I try to give them, treat them friendly. I enjoy being friendly, so it's not really work to me. It's just part of my personality.
Speaker 3.
So what's my best quality? I think my best quality has to be the ability to laugh at myself. English humor is very much based around laughing at yourself and also laughing with others at themselves. So my best quality definitely is that I can laugh at myself and with others when they laugh at me.
Speaker 4.
Since I'm a musician, I make music. And when I make music, I tend to create some kind of song. And then right away I go to the next one before I even finish the last one.
Speaker 5.
I want to find out new things. I want to go places. I want to have new experiences. I don't like to just sit around where I know everything because it stops being interesting and inspiring after a while. I like to have new things happen to me and meet new people, and that is what keeps me creative, and I have fresh ideas that way.
Speaker 6.
I say, you know, I want to do a big project, but then I realize, oh, wait a minute, you know what? I probably shouldn't have said anything because now everyone expects me to do it and I don't have any choice. Probably I should just do it and then talk about it later. You know, I have a bad habit of saying, gee, I think it would be a good idea if I did A, B, C. But then I think, oh, man, you know what? I don't think I'll be able to do that, at least not when I say I will.
This is the end of task 2. Turn to task 3. Task 3. You are going to hear a talk about the history of drinking water. You will hear the recording twice. Before you listen, read the sentences below. While you listen, tick the correct answer, A, B, or C. An example, 0, has been done for you. You now have 45 seconds to read the sentences.
Today, most of the people who are listening to this podcast or watching this on YouTube probably have the ability to get drinking water fairly easily. You can just turn the tap on. One could argue that a potable water supply is the most important municipal service, but this has not always been the case, obviously. I mean, water can carry a lot of pathogens. It can be very dirty. It cannot help you at all if it's done wrong. For most of us in the West, we probably don't really think about drinking water. So we wanted to know, when was the first time we took water from the environment and gave it to people in, say, cities or towns? When did we start harvesting water? For most of human history, the rivers were the highways of humanity. You know, we didn't have an I-75. We didn't have an I-5. We didn't have Route 66. You know, we had rivers. And those rivers stretched way out into the frontier, but they also went all the way down to the ocean, right? Those rivers and streams were the highways of history. So most cities, if you think about it, are based around where a river was. But that wasn't the only reason. It wasn't just because of transportation. Fresh water was needed for a populace. When we started colonizing this new world, we found all of these freshwater sources. You can trace the evolution of public water supply systems to the growth of larger populations throughout history. But when the populations began to get too large, that's when we needed to adapt and figure out a new way to get water, because you couldn't just get it out of the river. Surface water just wasn't enough anymore. So we started digging to get more water. Hello, distribution lines. Some of the earliest water distribution systems came from Persia around 700 BCE. They began constructing elaborate tunnel systems called kanats. And it's hard to say exactly how old they are, since most of the evidence for the age of kanats is circumstantial, but they're basically hand-dug tunnels which extract and transport groundwater. Now again, 700 BCE, that's a long time ago. They could run for miles, and every so often along the length of the tunnel there would be a vertical shaft where they could filter the water to allow for ventilation and repairs and all sorts of other things. It sounds a lot like a modern-day sewer, because that's a essentially what it is, but instead it was for drinking water. The tunnels had a gentle slope down from mountainous areas, and they would have an outlet at a village, though it didn't have to necessarily be nearby, since these things stretched for miles. If the water was going to be used for irrigation, they could have canals that would distribute that toward fields. But humans have been using these for centuries, and some of these are still in use today in Iran and Afghanistan.
Listen again and check your answers.
Today, most of the people who are listening to this podcast or watching this on YouTube probably have the ability to get drinking water fairly easily. You can just turn the tap on. One could argue that a potable water supply is the most important municipal service, but this has not always been the case, obviously. I mean, water can carry a lot of pathogens. It can be very dirty. It cannot help you at all if it's done wrong. For most of us in the West, we probably don't really think about drinking water. So we wanted to know, when was the first time we took water from the environment and gave it to people in, say, cities or towns? When did we start harvesting water? For most of human history, the rivers were the highways of humanity. You know, we didn't have an I-75. We didn't have an I-5. We didn't have Route 66. You know, we had rivers. And those rivers stretched way out into the frontier, but they also went all the way down to the ocean, right? Those rivers and streams were the highways of history. So most cities, if you think about it, are based around where a river was. But that wasn't the only reason. It wasn't just because of transportation. Fresh water was needed for a populace. When we started colonizing this new world, we found all of these freshwater sources. You can trace the evolution of public water supply systems to the growth of larger populations throughout history. But when the populations began to get too large, that's when we needed to adapt and figure out a new way to get water, because you couldn't just get it out of the river. Surface water just wasn't enough anymore. So we started digging to get more water. Hello, distribution lines. Some of the earliest water distribution systems came from Persia around 700 BCE. They began constructing elaborate tunnel systems called kanats. And it's hard to say exactly how old they are, since most of the evidence for the age of kanats is circumstantial, but they're basically hand-dug tunnels which extract and transport groundwater. Now again, 700 BCE, that's a long time ago. They could run for miles, and every so often along the length of the tunnel there would be a vertical shaft where they could filter the water to allow for ventilation and repairs and all sorts of other things. It sounds a lot like a modern-day sewer, because that's essentially what it is, but instead it was for drinking water. The tunnels had a gentle slope down from mountainous areas, and they would have an outlet at a village, though it didn't have to necessarily be nearby, since these things stretched for miles. If the water was going to be used for irrigation, they could have canals that would distribute that toward fields. But humans have been using these for centuries, and some of these are still in use today in Iran and Afghanistan.
This is the end of Task 3. Turn to Task 4. Task 4. You are going to hear an interview about New Zealand. You will hear the recording twice. Before you listen, read the sentences below. While you listen, complete the sentences. Write no more than 3 words in each gap. An example, 0, has been done for you. You now have 30 seconds to read the sentences.
So, Monica, you are from New Zealand.
Yes, that's right.
So, for people going to New Zealand, what would you recommend? What are 3 or 4 places that you must see in New Zealand?
Oh, okay, 3 or 4 places you must see. Well, depends what you're looking for, really. I think a lot of people that come to New Zealand enjoy an outdoor lifestyle, so there's lots of outdoor activities and places you can go to enjoy in New Zealand. Personally, I find the South Island of New Zealand very scenic in comparison to the North Island. So for me, a must-do is the west coast of the South Island. It's very pretty.
The west coast.
Yeah. In particular, there's 2 glaciers, Franz Josef and Fox Glaciers, which are very stunning to look at. And you can either have a look at them by foot, or you can pay for a helicopter ride that takes you up and shows you an aerial view of them.
Now, do people ever walk across the glaciers?
There are guides that can walk you across. Yeah, I haven't done it personally, but it is possible.
So what else would you recommend for New Zealand? What other places should people see?
I think if you want to see rural New Zealand, it's quite a nice idea to drive the length of the country, and then you can see the interesting farming that has taken place, in particular in the South Island, the lower part of the South Island, and a lot of the North Island as well. There's a lot of sheep in New Zealand, and there's a lot of cattle as well. I think it is always interesting to go for a drive and to see that firsthand.
So you just start up in Auckland in the north and drive all the way down south?
Yeah, well, there's many ways you can do it, but I recommend one way of doing it is to arrive in Auckland and to have an experience of a big city, well, a big city for New Zealand, and then drive down the center of the North Island and maybe have a farming experience somewhere. There's a lot of farm stay opportunities available for tourists who come to New Zealand. So depending on how you do it, you might want to stay 2 or 3 days with a family and experience a farming lifestyle And another is to maybe go to a city like Rotorua, which is really in the center of the North Island, and experience Māori culture. There's a Māori village there near the Whakarewerewa forest, which hosts a lot of tourists, and you get to experience Māori waiata, which is Māori songs, and you get to see the hot springs in New Zealand and thermal mud pools. So, yeah, Rotorua is a nice city to go and visit. And then work your way down to the capital of New Zealand, which is Wellington. And I think if you want to experience the cafe lifestyle of New Zealand, that's a good place to go.
Listen again and check your answers.
So, Monica, you are from New Zealand.
Yes, that's right.
So, for people going to New Zealand, what would you recommend? What are three or four places that you must see in New Zealand?
Oh, okay. Three or four places you must see. Well, depends what you're looking for, really. I think a lot of people that come to New Zealand enjoy an outdoor lifestyle. So there's lots of outdoor activities and places you can go to enjoy in New Zealand. Personally, I find the South Island of New Zealand very scenic in comparison to the North Island. So for me, a must-do is the west coast of the South Island. It's very pretty.
The west coast.
Yeah. In particular, there's two glaciers, Franz Josef and Fox Glaciers, which are very stunning to look at. And you can either have a look at them by foot, or you can pay for a helicopter ride that takes you up and shows you an aerial view of them.
Now, do people ever walk across the glaciers?
There are guides that can walk you across. Yeah, I haven't done it personally, but it is possible.
So what else would you recommend for New Zealand? What other places should people see?
I think if you want to see rural New Zealand, it's quite a nice idea to drive the length of the country, and then you can see the interesting farming that has taken place, in particular in the South Island, the lower part of the South Island, and a lot of the North Island as well. There's a lot of sheep in New Zealand, and there's a lot of cattle as well. I think it is always interesting to go for a drive and to see that firsthand.
So you just start up in Auckland in the north and drive all the way down south?
Yeah, well, there's many ways you can do it, but I recommend one way of doing it is to arrive in Auckland and to have an experience of a big city, well, a big city for New Zealand, and then drive down the centre of the North Island and maybe have a farming experience somewhere. There's a lot of farm stay opportunities available for tourists who come to New Zealand. So depending on how you do it, you might want to stay 2 or 3 days with a family and experience a farming lifestyle. And another is to maybe go to a city like Rotorua, which is really in the center of the North Island, and experience Māori culture. There's a Māori village there near the Whakarewerewa forest, which hosts a lot of tourists, and you get to experience Māori waiata, which is Māori songs, and you get to see the hot springs in New Zealand and thermal mud pools. So, yeah, Rotorua is a nice city to go and visit. And then work your way down to the capital of New Zealand, which is Wellington. And I think if you want to experience the cafe lifestyle of New Zealand, that's a good place to go.
This is the end of the listening paper. Now turn to the reading paper.